Okay, so this is our final class in this series about character traits, about midos. This turns out, based on the calendar, you know, next week Rosh Hashanah, week after is Erev Yom Kippur, then you have Sukkot and Shmini Atzeres, so you know Tuesday's available for next month to have class. So we'll meet again, I guess. I don't have a calendar in front of me, but it'll be the Tuesday after Simchas Torah, which I guess
I
about 5 weeks from now. So unfortunately, Tuesdays are busy this month. Or fortunately, it's busy with holidays.
So the first Tuesday after Simchat Torah.
Yeah.
Okay, Simchat Torah is Tuesday, October 6th. So Rosh Chodesh, it would be Rosh Chodesh, Tuesday, October 13th.
October 13th. Okay, so our next class, October 13th.
October 13th.
So this will have to last on this one for a while, I guess. Okay, so we're still discussing midos, character traits. And I wanted to try today to go through a little quicker a few more traits. I mean, we spent a lot of time on anger, we spent time on kindness, we spent time on arrogance. I want to try to cover, if we have time, about four other traits today, just I think important traits to think about. And remember, all these discussions are kind of keys to open up our minds to other character traits. I mean, they're all interconnected. You know, when you're kind, you're also generous, and when you have arrogance, that can make you angry, and they're all interconnected. So the more we understand various traits, the more we can open up our minds to understanding more of our own character. I just want to stress one more time as well, this is very appropriate prior to Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is the Day of Judgment, and the rabbis teach us that God acts towards us in the way we act towards others. If we act patiently, God acts patiently. If we act in kindness, you know, God acts in kindness. If we act with anger, then God acts with anger. So if we are able to treat others in appropriate ways, then God will treat us in those ways as well. So this is a merit that every single Jew could have as they approach the Day of Judgment, that if you work on the way you interact with other people and how you interact with yourself, then God will also respond in kind. So it's just important to constantly stress that, you know, during this season. So the first trait I want to focus on today is what we call the midas ha'emes, the trait of truth, honesty and truth. And I think it's surprising to some that usually we don't see honesty as a character trait. It's something we do. Either I tell a lie or I tell the truth. Either I'm honest or I'm dishonest. But the rabbis see that emes, that truth, is part of a person's character. It's a lifestyle. Because some people, just they live a life with, they can't speak words that are false. That just doesn't fit with them. And some people are able to deceive and to lie and to act in ways which are dishonest. And it's something which is kind of built into the person. It's not just something we do, but something which is part of our character. Because every single mita is something which is actually innate within us. So those who have the ability to lie means that within them there's some trait of falsehood. And those who can't utter a word of falsehood, that means they have the trait of truth within. The sages teach us that the reason that there is such a thing in this world as lies or falsehood is only due to our sins. Meaning what? Now why do I have to lie or cover anything up? It's because there's something, either I'm trying to deceive or steal, I'm ashamed of something, I'm trying to trick. Any lie is typically going to come into play because there's a sin involved, something inappropriate involved. Now it's interesting, the sages teach us as well, that there are times one's allowed to lie. If you're asking in terms of strict halacha, Jewish law, one certainly is allowed to lie in situations. Examples given are let's say one example is shalom bayis, peace in the household. If you're trying, if you're saying a lie will help promote peace and tranquility in a household. So again, obviously you have to do it with wisdom, you know, at the right time and place, with being very careful, because you're playing with fire every time you tell a lie, but it's permitted. The Torah records that even God himself lied to Abraham in order not to upset him, so he doesn't become upset with Sarah. So even God himself told a lie to promote shalom bayis, peace in the household. There are times where one is allowed to lie for reasons of humility or for reasons of modesty. There are examples that are given in the Talmud when lies are permitted. However, all these examples are only because of sin. Meaning that, why do I have to lie to promote shalom bayis, peace in the home? Because somebody did something which must have been a little bit wrong or inappropriate, and I don't want the spouse to find out, so I kind of, you know, make it a little bit more abstract or fuzzy so the spouse doesn't get upset. But it's only because something began that was a little bit off, and that's why the lie had to come into this world. So even if the lie is permissible halakhically, it doesn't mean that it's good, and doesn't mean that it's not. It's only here as a ex post facto type thing, because there's already something inappropriate or a sin which occurred, now the lie comes into place. I'm not going in today to a large discussion about when you're allowed to lie, when you're not allowed to lie. It's an interesting discussion we could have a different time, maybe. But you have to, whenever, even when halacha permits lying, you have to be super careful with how you use it. Because whenever you tell a lie, you're playing with fire. So that's something which is just important to put out there. And we know that Jacob, he had to deceive his father to get the blessings. Famous lie in the Torah. Jacob's looked at as a pillar of truth. But he felt at that point that lying was appropriate. So again, that's not today's discussion. I'm showing that our times where lying is called for, but it's always playing with fire, it's always very dangerous, and usually it's to be avoided. The sages teach us as well that if you speak the truth, you'll never come to falter or to stumble. We know the truth will always succeed and endure. Truth stands. The Talmud points out to us, even the Hebrew word for truth seems to allude to the fact that truth is eternal. Truth stands. Because Hebrew for truth, emes, aleph, mem, tuf. So the way it's written in the Torah, all three of those letters have two legs. Aleph has two legs, the mem has two legs, tuf has two legs. Find a marker, I put on the board, find another marker. The Hebrew word for lying is sheker, and those only have one leg, those three letters. Because something which is a falsehood, a lie, always topples over eventually. So it's like your house of cards. You're building something up on nothing. But truth will always stand. So every single letter in the word truth has two legs. Every letter in the word falsehood of Schechter has one leg. So that's also a very important lesson. That lying is something which we know will never endure. Lies are something which are, whether they're called for or not, it's something which doesn't have any standing in the long run. People who regularly lie, we know that people don't take them seriously. We know that people always question their words. They don't respect them. Even the sages point out that lying could even mean exaggerating, even slight variations or vagueness in our speech could also be a lie. If I'm speaking to somebody and they explain a concept to me, and I say, I understand, really I don't, which I'm sure we all do all the time, and then that's also a form of lying. And maybe, you know, it's not such a serious lie, it's very subtle, but it's also not 100% honest, because I don't really understand. I'm saying, I'm just trying to get you off my back, or I'm trying to move on, and I say, yeah, I understand, I get it. And we all do that all the time. There is a story in the Gemara, interesting story the Gemara tells us, about the great sage Rav. I don't know the background to this, but Rav apparently had a wife who did not treat him so nicely, and she would always try to cook for him the food he didn't want. That's what it says. So just for example, I forgot the exact foods the Gemara lists. If he said, I'd like to have some chicken for dinner, she'd make him pasta. I'd like pasta, she'd make him chicken. You know, I'd like apples, you give him an orange. So an orange, you give him apples. That was the relationship, unfortunately. I don't know why. That's how it was. So it's just that Rav's son caught on to this, and his son said, I have an idea. So Rav said to his son, I'd love to have chicken for dinner tonight. So his son would go to the wife and say that, you know, my father wants to have pasta. And the wife would say, aha, and she made chicken, right? And then next day, I'd like to have pasta for dinner. Okay, so the son goes to the wife and says, okay, my father would like to have some chicken for dinner, and she makes the pasta. So he is able to manipulate his mother to make the right foods for his father. Again, I'm not sure why his mother did this to his father, different issue, but that's the video. Yeah.
The father actually reprimanded the son because...
That's what I'm about to get to, right? So you know this story.
Yeah, because he said, look, I've got the best place in heaven because I've got a wife who treats you this way. You're taking the seat away from me.
So there's two points. That's one point that's made. Another point made is that he tells his son that even though what you're doing gets me what I need, it's still not honest. Because you went and told your mother a lie. You said that, you know, Abba would like to have chicken and really Abba wanted pasta. So he tells his son that Rav would never have dreamed of saying a lie. And commentators point out, Rav couldn't think of this. Rav was one of the greatest sages of the Talmud. He couldn't figure out that he could tell his wife the opposite of what he wanted and the wife make him what he wants. Why couldn't he figure this out all those years? The answer is, Rav just didn't, it didn't occur to him to ever lie. He couldn't do it. Because he was somebody who was so committed to truth, he wouldn't have dreamed of deceiving his wife in that way. So they could definitely use some maybe counseling or something, relationship like that, but, you know.
He could have said, what do you want for dinner? I want chicken, he said. And he could look at her and say, and don't make me pasta.
Yeah.
And without lying or manipulating, he could just add a sentence on, give her some,
right, yeah, but even a deception.
A little musa or something, huh?
Right. That's true, but I guess even just any sort of deception, you know, he didn't want to get involved in. Oh, you mean that he really wanted the chicken, and he just gives her mustard. Don't make.
And he said, "Then don't make me pasta."
Right.
That would have been lying.
That's true. Yes, I don't want to focus on Rob's wife. I don't know why the relationship was what it was. But my point is that when you're committed to truth, even when you know a lie, a very innocent lie, will get you what you need, it won't hurt anybody else, it'll actually correct the situation. Even then, when you're committed to truth, you don't say a lie like that.
One sentence I always remember, I said, do not do that which you would not have known. Right? Some famous person said that, and I always think of that as a reason not to lie.
You don't do to others as you want. As
no, do not do that which you would not have known.
Have not have known.
Which you would not have known.
Uh-huh.
Have known to the other people.
Right. I mean, if you don't want others to know it, don't do it yourself, because that's already showing. Right. That's a good point. That's always a good rule of thumb to have with you. Right. Very good. So truth is a mita. It's a character trait, something built within. You have to develop it within yourself. You have to learn how to appreciate truth, the significance of truth. And deep down, I think the way we should try to encourage ourselves to stick to truth is that we want our lives to be built on substance. We want our lives to be built on our true accomplishments, our true ideas, and people to know who we really are. Anytime you tell a lie, so then something is going to occur which is really built on nothing. I mean, a simple example, let's say you have a kid who cheats on tests in school. So based on their cheating, they move on into college, they get a job, everything else, but everything was based back on a lie. When we try to misrepresent who we are, so people understand us differently, and we're building lives based on fantasy, on an illusion. And people can live an entire lifetime in a fantasy mode, that everything that they do is really built on lies and falsehoods. People out there like that. We want to feel truly accomplished, and true accomplishments are based on our actual hard work and labor, not through cheating and deceiving and stealing. That's not an accomplishment. And when you look back at life, those things which you worked hard at, honestly, you feel very proud of and very accomplished. And things which you did, which were a little bit, inappropriate, a little dishonest, so those types of things we were ashamed of, and then no one will ever found out about it. You know, no one will ever know, and we move on and everything. But you're ashamed that you're building your life or your accomplishments or your business or your finances on something which is a little bit off. And that's something we want to be true people who live lives of substance and reality. I brought here a biography of Yaakov Kamenetsky, who was one of the greatest rabbinic leaders in America. Really, I guess, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. You know, he passed away, I think it was in the late 80s or something. I don't know the exact date. But he was known to be somebody who would stick to truth 100%. And so I wanted to share one or two points about him from the book, just stories, which I found to be powerful. They actually asked Rabbi Kamenetsky, they said to him, he lived well into his 90s. And they asked him, what's the secret of your longevity? Like, why did God allow you to live so long? And he said, very honestly, he said, I never told a lie. That's what he told people who questioned him. I never, ever told a lie. So, and there's stories and stories and stories in his biography about how honest he was. I just want to maybe share with you two different accounts. One was about somebody came to him for counsel. And she said that when she was a child, she was hit by a car. And her parents had sued the driver. So the attorney had instructed her to testify that she was crossing the street with the light when the car hit her. And that was not the truth. She was actually crossing against the light. But the attorney said, you know, you say you're crossing with the light. She listened to the attorney. And she won a substantial amount of money in this trial as a kid. It went into an escrow account because she was still a minor. And now she was an older woman. She was getting married. And she was ready to start her life. And she had the ability to claim the money from her escrow. And she went to Rabbi Kamenetsky. And the question was, what should she do with this money? So Rav Yaakov said to her, not only should you not use the money, so she thought, well, maybe I'll give it to tzedakah or something. He said, don't even give it to a Jewish tzedakah, only give it to a non-Jewish charity. And the reason was because he didn't want her to think that she can gain anything in terms of a mitzvah, in terms of her own personal life, based on dishonesty. So even though this trial was long gone, and she was a kid when it happened, etc. Rav Yaakov said that you can't build a life on dishonesty. You can't fool yourself to think that the perjury that she did in court somehow was compensated for by the mitzvah that she gave the tzedakah. So he said, give it to a non-Jewish charity. That would be the best thing you can do with it. That's what she was told. And that was Rav Yaakov's personal mita, that you can't build anything positive on dishonesty. There's one other story. Another story I wanted to tell here. I mean, he himself was very, very careful in how he spoke, in that he said for a brief period of time, he had on his answering machine, he had an answering machine on between the hours of 3 and 5 in the afternoon. And that is, and it instructed callers to call back after 5. So that was the message. You know, I'm away, call me back after 5 o'clock. Now, he stopped using the answering machine because since he wasn't always home right at 5 o'clock, he felt he was deceiving people. When I say call me after 5, it means I'll be available after 5. It says some days I'm only available at 5:15 or 5:30. So how can I say that on my answering machine? It'd be dishonest. And he wouldn't use the answering machine because he couldn't say the exact time he'd be available. He thought he was deceiving people. Just some very simple stories, which I mean, we might look at as extremes, but it was, what?
Change the message, I'll be available after 7.
Okay, so it could be changed. I don't know what else you may have changed it to at the end. But again, we look at these things as kind of extremes. But somebody who has the need of truth within and is so committed to truth, every single slight nuance of dishonesty is something which is important. I think I have one other story I wanted to share. Let me see if I can find it. Which one it was. Anyways, you mean everyone could pick up his biography. It's sold in stores. It's an archival book of Yaakov. And you can read about his truth and honesty. But he said the secret to his longevity was his honesty. That's what he said. So that's the idea of honesty. And again, this could be discussed a lot more at length, but I want to try to run through a few other concepts today. But we have to just recognize that it's a mita within, something which is built within ourselves, and we have to train ourselves to appreciate truth at all times and not to deceive or be dishonest in any way, shape, or form. The next trait I want to discuss, we refer to in Hebrew as leitsanus, which is like cynicism, sarcasm, cutting down others, deriding or defaming concepts. That's leitsanus. The scoffing, I think they're translated as. And the point of this concept of leitsanus, being a cynic, being sarcastic, is that we belittle, we poke fun at things of significance. And it's something which I think we are brought up with, especially in modern times. I mean, what do comedians do? What do you see on the news? What do you see in public media all the time? It's always poking fun, making fun, in some way, just defaming, denigrating others. And that's this mita. We look at people in positions of power, look at concepts, we look at ideas, organizations, institutions, and instead of seeing the positive, we try to poke fun at it, we try to point out the negative, and we act cynical, sarcastic, and in that way, we take away the ability of anybody of importance or significance or any concept to actually have any sort of power or influence in our lives. And then this is a mita. Some people, and I'm sure we know people like this, most of their conversation usually is based on this type of discussion, this type of speech. And no matter what you say, they always have something that they can point out which is wrong, something off, something which is inappropriate, something which is... They always try to cut things down and reduce them down to size. And it's kind of... their social interactions are built on sarcasm or cynicism. And no matter what's happening, they kind of brush it off as, it doesn't make a difference to me. It's something which everyone has to some degree. I think some people we know have this to a large degree and some to a smaller degree, but everyone has this within. People with this type of mita, they think they know it all. You know, I can see through everything. No one can fool me because no matter what's out there, not everyone's dishonest, everyone's insincere. No concept is so great, no person is so powerful or so righteous. And they think everything out there is kind of a cliche, insignificant. You know, there's nothing there which is actually real. There's a book called Orchos Yosher. It was written by Rav Chaim Kanievsky, one of the great sages who lives in Bnei Brak currently. And he quotes in there, he says that one of the greatest signs for foolishness, to show that somebody's not actually wise or foolish, is to have this mita. Because somebody who's wise looks for positive. They take concepts, ideas, people, and they try to zero in on the power which is there, the significance, the importance. And somebody who is foolish always tries to point out the negative and to deflate things and reduce them down to size. The sages even tell us, it says that there are certain groups of people who will not be able to receive God's presence in the future world. And one group of people is called the Kotletzim, the group of those who are scoffers, who are cynical, this type of mita. There's a famous quote as well that somebody can be up and giving a most powerful speech and inspiring and influencing others, that one wise guy who makes the comment can ruin everything. And, you know, the person might be right, might be wrong, but that should not detract from the entire powerful speech. So the rabbi gets up in shul, he gives an amazing sermon. Everyone is inspired, everybody's ready to go do good. And one guy in the back makes a comment, makes fun of it, you know, tries to find a flaw, tries to make fun of how the rabbi delivered it, and suddenly the power is gone. No one cares anymore. We all know what that's like. And that's this midah. So the guy might be, maybe the rabbi said it, you know, said something wrong. Maybe he made a mistake. Maybe he delivered it in the wrong fashion. I don't know. But why should that one comment take away the entire message is there? It's a terrible trait to have, because where you're pushing away all that's important. There's a commentary that points out that whenever one thought of cynicism or sarcasm enters the heart, one piece of Torah leaves the heart. Because Torah are those things which are important and significant and meaningful, with lessons, with morals. Every time I start questioning and I'm cynical and I'm negative and I try to deflate that which is important, so a piece of importance leaves me. And that's what a certain commentary says. We know that the nation which the Torah describes as kind of the arch enemy of the Jews, the nation of Amalek, so they are known for the trait of Leitzanus. The rabbis teach us that Amalek, they came in as the Jews were leaving Egypt, they're approaching Mount Sinai to receive the Torah, and what's the one nation that could not stand for a people to experience God's miracles, to receive God's law? It was Amalek. They could not stand that we would actually connect with God. They came in to fight us on the road, on the way to Mount Sinai. And the Torah tells us that Amalek was the first nation to fight us, and the ultimate end of Amalek will be total annihilation, total destruction. And the sages teach us that every single nation has their place, has their meaning in this world. Now, even though we respect all nations, not just Jews, we know that God creates every nation for a purpose. And in the future world, in God's final, in the world to come, in God's final plans, every nation has their place. They have what to contribute. They have their place to be honored. Except Amalek. Because a nation that's built totally on cynicism, on trying to deflate all that's important, there's no end to them. Because what positive is there? It's all negative. Everything there is just sarcasm and cynicism, and there's nothing more. So Amalek is a nation which, because they come to cut down all that's significant, they're never going to change and grow. There's no redeeming quality within them. Because redeeming quality is that even though I may not do X, Y, or Z, at least I do something positive. I have something positive to contribute. But all you contribute is negativity. It's cynicism and sarcasm, so what are you contributing? Absolutely nothing. So Amalek is looked at as the opposite of the Jews, that we are here to promote to the world that which is real and significant and important and moral and correct. And Amalek comes just to cut that all down and belittle it. So that's why they're our archenemy. Why do we so often engage ourselves in cynicism and negativity, in Leitzanus? So sometimes it's a defense mechanism, that because we sense our own personal vulnerability or weaknesses, so we don't want to see anybody else or anything else kind of succeeding, so we try to show everyone has weaknesses too. You know, nobody's perfect. So a lot of times it's a defense mechanism. It makes us feel good to cut down others. It could be coming from arrogance. It's the know-it-all attitude. I know everything. You know, nothing out there is going to impact me, phase me. Nothing's better than no one knows more than me because I know everything. It could come from arrogance. It could be because since nobody appreciates me for my positive contributions, so therefore, maybe I can become appreciated through my jokes and sarcasm. And like I said, and as we know, some people in their social circles, their whole standing is based on their ability to be sarcastic and cynical. And we know that's just their attitude. There are some times where the Talmud does encourage or permit this mita, leitzanus, such as it says that if you want to poke fun at idolatry, that's actually appropriate and positive. Meaning that when you have things in this world which truly are insignificant, and people are kind of risen up to be significant, you're supposed to poke fun at them. So idolatry was the primary example back then. Idolatry was where people were taking, you know, idols, which are worthless, and holding them up as gods. So our job is to go and be cynical, and be sarcastic, and belittle, and, you know, defame that idol to the best of our ability. Because I'm actually deflating something which is falsely inflated. It's falsely insignificant, so I have to make it insignificant. So the situations in life where there are things that are held up to be important, which is truly or not important, that's where you're supposed to employ leitzanus. But usually it happens the other way around. The things which are supposed to be important, they become deflated because that cynic out in the audience says something which is inappropriate. And overall, I think as a attitude in life, it's much better to be upbeat, positive, see the good, do good. It's much healthier. People are much happier that way. Rather than always trying to burst everyone's bubble with your negativity, try to be upbeat and positive and see everyone's positive values and positive traits. And I think people live a much happier lifestyle in that way. Those people who are cynics usually aren't too happy because everything around them is negative and bad and insincere and unimportant, etc. So that's, in short, this idea of Leitzanus. And we see how it connects, because being a cynic, being negative, it really connects with, like I said before, connect with arrogance, it could connect with a lack of self-worth, it connects with a lot of the other traits which are out there. So that's the trait of Leitzanus. I want to discuss another one. And again, I apologize for running through so quickly, but I think it's just good to have a little concept of each and every one. The other one we'll discuss is jealousy, kina. Jealousy is a trait which definitely plagues all of us at some point in our lives, if not always. Jealousy could be jealousy of possessions, it could be talents, it could be money, it could be life accomplishments, situations, jobs, etc. Jealousy is something which pervades every area of life. The sages teach us, they say that somebody who is jealous of another, so the terminology used by the sages is atzmosav markivim, their bones will rot. As it says, we quote a verse, I believe it's in Proverbs, it says, rekev atzmos kina, that kina, the jealousy, is the rot of the bones. Now obviously it's a metaphor. What's the metaphor of the bones rotting? So I think it's very, very simple. I think when one's jealous of another, so that means that you're focused purely on what others have and not focusing on your own personal virtues. So basically, you're rotting yourself away because you're not focusing on what you have, focusing on what you don't have. So if you want to take the analogy, so your bones are rotting because your bones are what keep you strong. It keeps your body in form. But if you totally ignore who you are, so you're basically decaying yourself and it's looking out towards others. We appreciate ourselves. It says that if you don't have jealousy, your bones don't rot. Because you appreciate what you do have, you're appreciating you're appreciating the haves, not the have-nots. When we only look for what we don't have, then we're rotting ourselves away, and we're looking towards others. And we try to see that everyone has everything that I need, and I have nothing that I need. That's jealousy. Jealousy is a mida because it means that you're never focused on your own personal virtues. You don't focus on your possessions, on your own tools, your own accomplishments. You're always looking at others. And we kind of eat away at ourselves. That's the rot, that's the decay which jealousy kind of brings us to. The jealousy doesn't allow us to capitalize on our own personal potential. Because we're always saying, if only I had this, if only I could do that, if only I was that smart, or I had that talent, then I could accomplish. We use it sometimes as an excuse. Since I'm missing X, Y, or Z, I can't accomplish what I need to do. So for a person to capitalize on their own personal talents, and everyone has talents, everyone has virtues, everyone has something they can offer the world. But we don't capitalize on that because we're always looking outwards, not looking inwards. Jealousy also, the rabbis teach us, is a much deeper expression of denying God in a certain sense. It's a denial of God's providence in this world. Why is that? Because the way we understand it is that everybody is given a package from God. You're given a body, you're given possessions, you're given a family, you're given life, etc. And those are the tools God has given you to perform your job in this world. So when I'm jealous, I'm questioning God. I'm saying, well, God, you gave me this tool, these tools, but I'd be better off with that tool. That's what we're saying exactly. I mean, it's just to take an analogy, so somebody is training to be a basketball player, and you say, I'm going to give you a frying pan for you to take to work. I mean, I like frying pans, but if I'm trying to play basketball, it's not going to help me. It's only going to get in my way. Somebody is an accountant, or is this somebody's a plumber, or an accountant. So you give the plumber a computer program for taxes. I don't know. You think about the analogy. And he says, I'll get used to it at home, but it doesn't do me much good on the job. And I'm trying to unclog a toilet, and a computer program's not going to do anything for me. And vice versa. You take the accountant, you give him a drill. He says, okay, well, I mean, if I'm home and I have to do a house project, it's fine, but it doesn't help me at work because I have to work on accounting. So we have to understand that God gave us all our lives. He gave us our tools for our purpose in life. And that's what we have. So we say, God, I'm jealous of this other person, but he has a nicer car than me. He has a better job than me. Or because his body is stronger than mine, or because I had to suffer through a difficult time in life, he didn't have that difficulty. So we're saying, God, you gave me the wrong tools. That's what we're saying. You know, you're telling God, really, I want to be a plumber, but you gave me a frying pan. That's what we're telling God. But God knows what we're supposed to do. So God tells you, no, you're a plumber, and I'm giving you the plumbing tools. That's what I'm giving you. But we're trying to question God in that sense. So we're not doing it actively. When someone's jealous, we're not thinking in our heads, oh, I'm questioning God, you know, God's providence over my life. But deep down, if we understood that God gives us all the tools that we need to perform our goals in life, then there's no reason for jealousy. Because if I were to get that other car, or I wasn't to have that challenge in life, or I was to get that other job, it's going to be the wrong tool. And that's not going to help me produce what I need to produce in lifetime. So it's an important attitude to have in life in general. But so again, all of us, we have our times of jealousy, and we don't think in our heads that I'm questioning God. That's not our thought process. But deep down, the way that we can work on jealousy is to understand that what I have is what I need. The concept of being happy with your lot, I mean, we'll talk about that more in a minute. But happy with your lot means that because my lot is what I'm supposed to have in life to fulfill my purpose. And the other person's lot, even though I'm jealous of it, won't help me fulfill my purpose. It's not going to be productive for me to have that other tool, that other, whatever we're talking about. Yeah.
And sometimes in the Torah, Hashem describes himself as a jealous God.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, what is with that? Maybe it's a different word or a different meaning.
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. There is a concept we look at, like a concept called kanoi. It means that we call it more zealous than
zealous.
Yeah. We talk about God having kina. So as I mentioned before, a lot of it, it's an expression. I mean, God doesn't actually have these traits. God expresses traits. So if he were a human being, he might be feeling this way, that way, this way. So God kind of is described in that manner. But I think in general, if you look at the translations in those contexts, they look at it more as a zealous than a jealous God.
Yeah.
But it's a good question. It's a very good question. Now, there are times where the Talmud tells us jealousy is appropriate, and that's coined in a phrase, kina sofrim tar bechachma, that the jealousy of scholars increases wisdom. Because if you're jealous of someone else's wisdom, that's going to be a motivating factor for you to gain your own wisdom. Now, just to put it into context, I mean, jealousy can be used often as a motivation to produce on your own. And there's a big difference between jealousy in that I wish I had it versus I wish he didn't have it. I think there's one point there. I mean, just because someone else has more wisdom than me, my gaining the wisdom doesn't attract his wisdom. And also there's the concept that as long as I can be jealous in a situation where my jealousy is not because I wish I could be like him. It's just that because I know what he has is something of value. So you have to draw the fine line between I wish I had that money versus I wish I had that wisdom. There is a fine line to be drawn over there. But ultimately, there is times where you can use jealousy as a motivational factor in order to push yourself. I mean, because if someone can mistake the trait of jealousy and say, well, I should just do nothing, God will give me what I need, and I shouldn't want anything else beyond myself. I mean, in a certain sense, that's true. In a certain sense, that's ridiculous, because we have to always be putting forth the right efforts in this world to succeed. And God does want us to go for the right job. And you know, I should work towards a promotion. It's just that I should work towards a promotion because I feel this is my proper step in life, not because I'm jealous of others having the promotion. And there's another fine line to be drawn over there. But the Talmud tells us that you could use jealousy as a motivational factor in terms of gaining your own personal wisdom. Now we'll move on to one final trait, and we'll close with this one.
Your own personal wealth.
Your own personal wealth, right.
Not your
wealth, yeah. Your wisdom, not your wealth. Right, your wisdom, not your wealth.
What about being jealous of a person who's doing a mitzvah, some kind of mitzvah? I mean, is that in the same category as their knowledge or something?
I think in the same category, but it's just that the thought process to be, not that I wish he didn't do it, it's just I wish I had that merit as well, you know? It's interesting, I wish he didn't do it, and you look negatively upon a person, that's certainly inappropriate jealousy. Why does his success in any way infringe upon you? And that's actually a good point to bring up, which I forgot to bring up, which is that part of jealousy, when you have that jealousy which is saying, I wish that person didn't have it, so that's also a lack of understanding how God runs the world. Because if God's giving us our tools to succeed, if another person succeeds, that doesn't infringe upon us. If God wants me to succeed, I'll succeed anyways, in my own way. The fact that another person succeeds does not in any way impact my own personal success. And that's also very important to understand as Jews, that God runs the world in that way, that we will succeed in our own ways, regardless of other success. So that's another point about jealousy, which is important to share.
So you're speaking against competition as a motivation?
Yes and no. You know, there are halakhas in the Torah about competing, and the Torah recognizes competition as something which you have to be careful with. On the other hand, we have to understand that just because if God wants me to succeed, I'll succeed regardless of the other business. If I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, I'm acting according to God's Torah and God's halacha, and I build up a business. And I also have someone else down the block who builds up a similar business. But God has enough money to give both of us. And He wants us to succeed, we'll succeed regardless of the other one. So it takes a lot of emunah and to understand that God runs the world in that way. But ultimately, we see that God has wealth to spare. You know, and He can give everyone what they need.
But maybe you shouldn't there be any meaningless things like competitive sports.
Competitive sports.
Or a chess team or anything like that.
Right. So again, you can argue, but that the competition there is not... Yes, the game is to beat the other person. But we're both engaged in, you know, something, whether it be healthy, intellectually healthy, physically healthy, entertaining. I mean, I think there is... It's not just trying to say I don't want his success. It's part of the game. It's an interesting point. The last trait I want to discuss is the trait of simcha, happiness. Simcha we view as an internal feeling of content. I mean, in Hebrew, in the Torah's language, there's many synonyms for being happy, and each synonym always has a little different nuance to it. And the way the commentaries describe simcha is that simcha is not an external expression of happiness, but it's an internal feeling of being content, a feeling satisfied, a feeling complete. You're settled, you're accomplished. When people are sad or depressed, it's because they feel lacking. It kind of is the opposite of simcha. Means I feel internally complete, I have what I need. And atzva, sadness, depression, is where I feel I'm lacking something. There's something which I'm missing, something I've lost. It actually very much relates with jealousy, because the rabbis teach us about being sameach v'chelko, being happy with our portion. And happy with our portion means that I don't feel lacking, I appreciate what I have, and that brings me simcha. So appreciation of what we do have is the opposite of wanting what we don't have. Jealousy is where I want what the other has, and simcha, happiness, comes to appreciating what I do have. Jealousy usually leads to sadness and depression, because that means that I'm focusing on my lacks, I'm not focusing on my haves. So the key to simcha really is to appreciate those that which we do have. Appreciate our lives, appreciate beauty, appreciate success that we do have, appreciate our friends, our community. Everyone has those things to appreciate. It's to have that positive focus, you know, the glass half full attitude, not the glass half empty attitude. That's the idea of Sameach
Mechelko. Yeah. I just have to tell you real quickly, my grandma of blessed memory, her blessing for you would be, I wish you want for nothing.
Right. Right. And that's the greatest blessing. Yeah, that brings the person the greatest happiness. There's being vulnerable brings us to sadness, because we feel that we have a lack, we have a weakness. It's interesting, in the language, the word simcha, samach, sin mem ches, relates to the word, at least the way it's pronounced, samach, samich mem chaf, to be supported. And there are commentaries that always say in Hebrew, even if words are spelled differently, if they have the same, I don't know what you call it, entomological, I don't know exactly which word to use, but they have the same sounds, then they relate. So samach, to be happy, is what to samach mean, to be supported. And we feel support on all sides. We don't feel vulnerable. We feel that we're taken care of. We're very happy because we feel complete. If we don't feel supported, we're lacking in samach, then we're lacking in simcha. We're lacking in happiness. One major training exercise for happiness, which is built into a Jew's routine, is blessings on food, blessings on the world, blessings on pleasure, the brachos that we make. Because brachos train us in developing appreciation for that which we have. If every time I take a bite of an apple, beforehand I really think, thank you so much, God, for providing me with this delicious apple, I'm appreciating this one simple pleasure in life. And the more we train ourselves every single day to appreciate the simple pleasures, we end up being happier people, because we're not looking at what we don't have, we're focusing on the pleasures that we do have. Additionally, bitachon, trust in God, breeds simcha, breeds happiness. Because, like we said before, you're happy when you feel cared for. When you feel somebody is there who's going to always fill in for your needs and your lacks, that makes you feel happy. because you feel content. You feel that you're complete. So the more that we develop a trust in God, an awareness of God in life, that should make us happy, because then we feel that someone's always there to take care of us and watch out for us no matter what. Those are two different exercises you can have in Simcha. Focusing on brachos, appreciating that which God gives us, and appreciating God's care and having trust in God. Those are two different areas which bring us to Simcha. And it goes beyond just brachos. I mean, just in life, if we learn how to appreciate what's around us, whether you make a bracha or don't make a bracha, that gives us Simcha. To be able to walk outside, appreciate fresh air, a beautiful day, a tree, be able to walk and breathe, you know. So we have brachos, actually, which are coined for these purposes, but just to appreciate that we have, it's an important thing. Someone who's sick and feels better, appreciate, wow, it's good to feel good. It's good to feel like myself. And the simple things that happen to us all the time that we don't just stop and dwell upon and appreciate, but if we did, it would bring much more Simcha into our lives. There's one area of Simcha which is very important for us as well. It's called Simcha Shel Mitzvah, having the happiness in doing a mitzvah. In last week's Parsha, we read the terrible tochacha, all the different warnings and admonitions God gives us and punishments for not following the Torah. And one line of tochacha says that why is this all coming upon us? It says, Tachas Shel Lo Vadas Hashem Lekecha, you didn't serve Hashem your God with simcha, with happiness. So commentaries dispute the actual meaning of that verse, but some say it means that even if the Jews were actually performing the mitzvahs and doing the right things, they didn't enjoy it. They didn't have joy in performing mitzvahs. And by the lack of joy in performing mitzvahs, that brought upon them all this tragedy. The famous work, the Kuzari, he describes there's three pillars of serving God. So two of them we're used to. There's the love of God, there's the fear of God. He says the third pillar, he says, is serving God with joy. That's the third pillar in serving God. There's loving God, fearing God, and simcha. Why is it so important? Because when you have simcha and a mitzvah, it shows the mitzvah something which brings me to accomplishment, to fulfillment. If I'm doing mitzvah without simcha, then I'm just obeying, I'm just following instructions, I'm just trying to get by. It's something that's not part of me, that I don't feel that I'm actually performing or accomplishing anything meaningful in life. But if I perform a mitzvah with simcha, you know, I go to shul and I enjoy, I have a simcha that I'm in shul. I have a simcha to go to shul and hear the shofar. I have a simcha to eat piece of matzah on Pesach. I have a simcha to go and visit somebody who's sick. If that gives me joy, that shows that I feel completion, fulfillment through what I'm doing. Just an analogy. So you can compare, let's say, a worker in a company to the founder of the company. The founder has a vision, and every single happening in that company for him brings him a feeling of accomplishment and of completion because his vision is being carried out. If you're just an employee doing a simple task, so you're just there because you have to make some money, you're being obedient, you're doing your job, but you don't feel a deep, I mean you might, but many employees don't feel this deep sense of simcha because they're just carrying out a task. They don't feel it's not a completion, it's not something which is carrying out their visions and their fulfillment in life. So mitzvah is something which we should feel is bringing us to our greatest fulfillment in life, and our greatest sense of accomplishment, and thereby it brings us simcha. So every single mitzvah should be done with a great feeling of simcha. So simcha has, you know, very broad meanings. If simcha is just an attitude of life, it's walking around with a sense of feeling content, and feeling complete and accomplished, and feeling that appreciating what I have. Simcha trains us to look at the world in a positive way and appreciate all that's around us. And then simcha on a more, I guess, local level is a simcha and a mitzvah. That as Jews, we should find our greatest joy in the service of God. Doing good, helping others, performing God's mitzvahs, keeping the Torah. Those things should bring us such a sense of joy because we know that's bringing us to the greatest fulfillment that a person can have. So these are just, we had four mitos we ran through today. These are, you know, there's dozens of mitos that could be discussed. But we'll see, they all relate. And I hope just over the past few weeks, we've always come more aware of the different, you know, aspects of our own personalities and our own the areas in which we can all focus on and grow as people. So every single mita can be defined and discussed, both from Torah sources, even like psychologists have written at length about different character traits. But it's our job to just be in touch with who we are, in touch with ourselves. And I hope that all of us can think about, so when we talk about truth or negativity or jealousy, how much of that is within ourselves? How jealous am I? How devoted am I to truth? And each one of us, it's incumbent upon us that we should be able to take each mida and try to figure out where do we stand and how can we grow? And in what way, what's our technique we can use to develop ourselves to be greater people? So everybody, Ksiva Chasima Tova, a good year, which we inscribed and sealed in the Book of Life. And look forward to meeting again. We said October, whatever it was, 13th, I think.
It was yeah. Benjamin Franklin that said, do after that, which
Franklin.
He had a lot of mistresses.
Yes.